Oh, another interesting fact I forgot to point out, as long as I've got the South American map back here, is that this same region, which is being heavily militarized, this whole Amazon Basin region stretching into the Putumayo area in Colombia and the Oriente area in Ecuador and this little bit of the northern Peruvian rainforest as well, precisely the region which is being targeted in the Andean Initiative for massive militarization and, in fact, ethnic cleansing, is also, if you look at the global satellite maps of which map world oil resources for the U.S. Geological Survey, this is also a massively oil-rich region, and it's being effectively exploited in Ecuador. It hasn't been effectively exploited in Colombia because it's not under control. You know, the guerrillas are extremely active there, and it's not under control. Now, northern Colombia is also part of the same basic, you know, basin of oil resources. Northern Colombia, it is being exploited by the likes of Occidental Petroleum and British Petroleum, because northern Colombia is largely under control thanks to the paramilitaries, which are working hand in glove with the Colombian army. But this region is not under control, and that's where the big thrust of, you know, the Plan Colombia and Andean Initiative is. This is also where the oil fields in Venezuela are also part of the same geological region, which is extremely oil-rich, and they've been exploiting it ever since the 1930s. They've been exploiting it very effectively in Venezuela, but now perhaps it's in danger as well because of the nationalist regime of Hugo Chavez, who's now demanding that the Venezuelan government get a larger cut of the profits for social programs and redistribution and so on. So making it more imperative than ever that they continue to expand exploitation south into this region, which has been targeted for the militarization. So once again, the militarization and the corporate designs follow each other. And, you know, is that a conspiracy theory? No, that's a fact. I mean, if you want to, you know, theorize that the Plan Colombia is basically, you know, whoring for Exxon and Occidental Petroleum, well, I suppose that would be a theory. But it's a fact that the area which is targeted for corporate exploitation is the same area which is being targeted for militarization. It's not a theory, it's a fact.
Pretty much the same model, too, now is going on in Indonesia.
That's right. In Indonesia, where there's this whole spate of paranoia recently about an Al-Qaeda presence in Aceh, where there is a separatist movement going on, and all sorts of human rights atrocities have been carried out by the Indonesian military. Similarly, Exxon has got their operations there. Similarly, Exxon is paying the Indonesian military to protect their oil facilities in Aceh. And similarly, the U.S. wants to resume military aid to Colombia, to Indonesia, which was expended, which was cut off due to human rights concerns under the Suharto regime. They're now talking about the Bush administration now wants to resume it. And once again, pick up the tab for Exxon of protecting their oil operations in Aceh. So it's the same model in Indonesia as well.
Where do you see FARC going? Do you think they're going to be crushed by the seething drain and losing revenue from cocoa? Or do you see them getting more...
They're not losing any revenue from cocoa. And primarily, as I say, it's been the paramilitaries, the right-wing paramilitaries in the north of the country, which actually control the trade routes, which actually control the smuggling routes, and actually act like a cartel. The FARC traditionally has just been taxing the cocoa growers, providing a protection racket for the cocoa growers, and not for the smugglers, but for the growers. Now, because this area is so thoroughly under their control, and now the new cartel is their most deadly enemy, the AUC, the paramilitaries. the FARC is beginning to get into controlling the smuggling routes as well. And the FARC is beginning to also move in this direction of becoming a cartel. But it's not nearly advanced with the FARC as it is with the AUK, with the right-wing paramilitaries. Nonetheless, you know, that is the direction that they're going. They're moving in a more sort of criminal, overtly thuggish direction and a less ideological direction. They're acting more and more like, you know, I hate to say it, they're acting more and more like so-called narco-terrorists, like an actual criminal machine which employs criminal tactics as opposed to an actual guerrilla army. Nonetheless, because the peasants in this region depend on them intimately for their actual, you know, physical survival, you know, in terms of, you know, their income from the coca leaf and protecting them from the forces which are attempting to relocate them and exterminate their economy, they've got a lot of support. You know, it's a sort of a totalitarian and cynical strategy, but it's an effective one. They do actually have a great deal of support in that region. So it's already awful bloody, and if they're really going to be crushed, it's going to get an awful lot bloodier, without a doubt. It's not going to be easy.
Do you see them making any major gains, or do you see it as going to be a standoff spark for a long time?
I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know what's going to happen.
I don't know anything about it.
But, you know, I know that they're now beginning to, when I say acting more like terrorists, they're beginning to do, you know, more like, you know, setting off bombs in the cities and that sort of thing, like you just saw with their attacks during the inauguration, as opposed to the more, you know, traditional guerrilla tactics, the actual, you know, blowing up buildings. Yeah.
Is it true that about one fourth of the coming people are internal refugees?
I don't know. I can't tell you what the figure is, but in terms of a fraction, but I believe that the numerical figure is 1.5 million internally displaced people over the past 20 years. Now, contrast that with the just over 500,000 who were displaced from Kosovo by the Serbs, which was, you know, rightly seen by the world as a terrible war crime and resulted in Serbs getting bombed by NATO. I mean, there's arguably worse crimes going on by, you know, which the United States is actually planning and directing and backing and funding in Colombia.
Yeah. I belong to a community that's a sister city of San Jose de Puerto, and I know that...
Where are they?
I don't know. I've got to go look at the map. Okay. I also heard that there was an effort made to construct a canal.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. The Colombian Canal, the Colombian route.
Well.
Yeah, through the Chocó region.
That's right.
Exactly right there. Which river is that? Is that the
And that there a huge portion of indigenous people here have been displaced, primarily to make room for multinational corporations.
Right, for British Petroleum. That's right. British Petroleum is very active here. And British Petroleum has actually been implicated through intermediaries in actually funding the paramilitary groups to you know, clear land for their oil operations. This is also the same region where they're planning on building a Colombian canal route right here through the flatlands of this river valley west of the Andes. And this is also primarily the region of the Afro-Colombians, who have constitutional guarantees for control of their traditional lands, which are fast being eroded through this, you know, this de facto ethnic cleansing which is going on, which you hear nothing about in the press in this country. Not a word. You know, unless you subscribe to, you know, all these Columbia Solidarity type newsletters and so on, you don't know anything about it. Yes?
Just to comment, I guess, I thought it was interesting that the celebrations for independence of East Timor were hardly over. I think the people that U.S. and I think, I can't remember who else, but people were trying to do, I think, were interested in making some deals about the oil reserves in the Straits.
Sure.
Of East Timor, yeah. Oil gas, I can't remember.
I wouldn't think they did. Sure.
But, and did you see the article in Monday's New York Times about Saudi Arabia possibly being labeled
Monday's New York Times? Did we see that in Monday's New York Times?
Well, what do you think?
Yeah, at Monday's New York Times, there's an article, this report. I think.
Were you talking about the controversial statements by the RAND analyst who was contracted by the Pentagon? Right, that was reported earlier in the Washington Post.
Okay.
Right, who said that that Saudi Arabia is not a reliable ally in the war on terrorism, and that the Pentagon may have to target the Saudi Arabian oil fields. And they left it very ambiguous exactly what they meant.
They said seizure or something.
The target was the word that they used.
That was journalist Bill Weinberg speaking last month in Plainfield, Vermont. Thanks to George King for that recording. You're listening to Unwelcome Guests on WEOS Geneva or WXXE Fenner Syracuse. As Weinberg detailed in our first hour, Colombia has been locked in a civil war for more than 20 years. The FARC guerrillas have become battle-hardened in this long war, but were probably in the beginning much like our next speaker, Javier Sanchez. Small farmers and villagers fighting the destruction and theft of their homes, land, and culture by a government working in collusion with foreign capital. Sanchez, however, is part of a group of people taking a different path to survival. He is a resident of the peace community of San Jose de Apartado in Colombia. Sanchez came to Ithaca last June as part of a national tour organized by the Fellowship of Reconciliation and the Committee on U.S.-Latin American Relations at Cornell. He spoke through a translator to Lucas Shapiro.
My name is Jutta Maya Wiedenbach. I'm the Colombia Program Coordinator for the Fellowship of Reconciliation. And the Colombia Program is accompanying with two volunteers, the peace community in northern Colombia, San José de Apartado.
Mi nombre es Javier Sánchez, soy colombiano, soy de la Comunidad de Paz de San José de Apartado.
So, my name is Javier Sánchez, I am Colombian, and I'm from the peace community San José de Apartado.
Do you want to tell us a little bit about why you're here and the story that you'd like to tell us?
Pues, fundamentalmente, he venido aquí pues, a contar como la experiencia de mi comunidad.
Mm-hmm. Well, basically, I'm here to talk about the experience in my community as an alternative community in Colombia.
Y también más que todo pues como para que aquí pues en Estados Unidos mucha gente no conoce la realidad que está
en Colombia. Because I think that many people here in the States don't really know the reality in Colombia, and by me talking about our experience people can find out more about the Colombian reality.
Nosotros, como población civil, como campesinos del campo, pues...
Because in Colombia, there's a conflict, which is basically a war going on, that above all is affecting the civilian population. We, as peasant farmers, we have had to live this conflict from very close.
En Colombia, a través de este enfrentamiento que hay entre las guerrillas y el Estado, son dos fuerzas y que eso.
In Colombia, the conflict is between the guerrilla and the state, and we, the campesinos, we're in the middle and don't really know what to do about this conflict. In Colombia, there's more than 2 million displaced people. People who have been forced to leave their houses, to leave their little farms, and who basically lost everything. Many times their farms and houses have been burnt down, things have been robbed from them. Basically, our territory is in dispute, and we, the campesinos, in 96, we had to leave our houses. Many of them were burnt down, and we had to flee.
So this is the area that's between the area of control that the guerrillas have? Is it the FARC? And then, or is this in a different area?
Estos territorios, pues sabemos que antes, los años 88, 89, 90, eran, pues...
So these are territories that, like in the mid-80s, early 90s, were dominated by the guerrillas, by the FARC, politically and militarily. And this is not only in Urabá where we are, but in other parts of the country also. But seeing that that they were gaining a lot of space militarily and also politically, they even had like presidential candidates, and you know, it looked like they were gaining a lot more power. And that's when the state starts, you know, creating their strategy. They start creating groups that do social cleansing and paramilitary groups to murder all the sympathizers of the Unión Patriótica Party or the Communist Party. Many of the members of the Unión Patriótica or the Communist Party were murdered, and the few that were left basically had to leave the region. Some of them, had to flee the country. So we were in a territory that had been territory of one armed group, and that was taken over, was being taken over by the other group. And that's when we started to organize ourselves as a community, saying that we're going to say no to any weapons and no to any of the armed groups. But this has been very difficult for us. For example, lately, even though the FARC has really failed politically, it has been strengthened militarily. So in recent times, they've really strengthened militarily with more personnel, with more weapons, and they're still in a lot of the territory.
I have a question back to, I think, the scene in the 80s when the two political parties, the Patriotic Union and the Communist Party, were those the political wings of essentially the FARC?
Eran muy de cerca. Eran muy cercanos.
Okay. They were very close.
So they've lost, the political wing was pretty much eliminated, and that's the military wing is what kind of stayed on. Mm-hmm.
Sí, yo creo que a través pues, de toda esta matanzas de las masas y todo eso, pues yo creo que políticamente, yo creo que... Que perdieron, sí, perdieron.
It's more that through their actions of killings and massacres, mm-hmm. that they have lost a lot of political force. There's still regions where also politically they're in control, but they've lost a lot of that. So our territory continues to be in dispute, but on the 23rd of March of 97 declared ourselves a peace community, and we're still there.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about the process of how people came together to organize mm-hmm. a peace community, how that went about?
Sí. Nosotros, al ver todo este conflicto, todas estas masacres, muchos desplazados ya antes lo venían haciendo. Entonces nosotros pues comenzamos a mirar.
Well,
pues,
we, seeing what was happening, all the massacres and the displacement, because many people were leaving. We were thinking, well, what alternatives are there? Because we were very clear that we didn't want to leave our lands. So after many workshops and consultations with many different people, we reached the conclusion that we would declare ourselves the peace community San José de Apartado. So we were many people coming together this 23rd of March, 97, signing the declaration. We were displaced from the outskirts to the town center, but it was very difficult because the the territory was still in dispute, and it was by now controlled by the paramilitaries, and they controlled the road that leads from Apartado to San José de Apartado, and there were lots of massacres and selective killings on that road.
How many people are we talking in the peace community?
Antes que desplazase la gente, en nuestro territorio habían unas 3,000 personas.
Before, in all of our in the parts of our communities, we were about 3,000 people. But you know, many people left, and then by the time we declared ourselves peace community, we were 520 people.
So these people left under the threat of violence from primarily the paramilitary groups.
Sí, sí. Allá en mi pueblo, en la región, el desplazamiento.
Yeah, in the region where I'm from, the displacement was carried out by the military and paramilitaries. But through all the success that we've had as a peace community, many people have returned, and by now the community has about 1,300 people again.
Are these people who are returning, who had left, or people who are displaced anyway and are looking for a special, you know, sanctuary?
Yo creo que iguales partes. Okay. Muchas fue que vivían ahí, se fueron, y luego al ver que todo se iba como, ¿no? Porque la comunidad iba retornando.
So it's almost equal parts. There were lots of people who had lived there before, left, and then seeing how this community was working out, came back. And there were other people who saw also the successes of the community and thought, well, I'm going there. At least I can work there. This really is an alternative. It's a, you know, peace community, and it's a community for life. And you know, with all the difficulties that there are, we have been very successful in these past 5 years.
Pero que también hemos tenido muchísimas dificultades, porque el Estado no nos ha reconocido.
But we've also really had a lot of difficulties because, for example, the state has not, does not really want to recognize us. They've not done anything.
Why is this?
Primero porque estamos en unas tierras donde el Estado quiere sacarnos. No quiere que volvamos.
Well, first of all, because we're in a place where the state doesn't want us. They want to get rid of us there. And also because we talk, we denounce everything that is happening there. We denounce what the state is doing or what the military together with the paramilitary is doing. So that's another reason. In these 5 long years that we've been there as a peace community, 107 of our compañeros have been murdered, 90% of those by the state through their paramilitary strategy, and a 10% by the guerrilla, by the FARC.
So when you're talking about those people who returned to the peace community, I mean, this was a very courageous move because it wasn't as if, you know, the violence had stopped.
Sí, yo creo que los que arrancamos con el proceso, yo creo que tomamos una decisión. Primero en defender nuestras tierras, resistir en medio de la guerra.
Yeah, we who started this process, we started by making this decision, and you know, it does take a lot of capacity building, a lot of decisions that are difficult to remain in this place that is still in a conflict zone. So those people who have come back, those families, they decide free, you know, it's their decision to be there, and they go through a process of like I said, capacity building, workshops, and you know, they decide freely to participate and to be under those principles. many of those families who have come back, they've already had the experience of living in the city and how difficult that is. You know, many of the young people, or you know, people are begging for money. People start robbing. You know, young people become drug addicts, and so they come back very decidedly that you know they want to stay on their lands and die on their lands if they have to. But now, like I said, I was talking about a few advances and successes. By now, about 100 families have been able to return to their lands. Coming back or returning means, you know, returning to their homes, returning to their lands, and being able to work again. But there's also something that's really fundamental, and that is the accompaniment, and especially the international accompaniment for the community. Because, you can't be alone in a conflict zone. It's very difficult. So the people accompanying, they see what the community is doing. They're witnesses to what the community is doing, and they're also witnesses to the human rights violations that the state is committing.
So these are people that are international observers from differing NGOs or groups like the Fellowship for Reconciliation?
Sí, en nuestra comunidad acompañan algunas organizaciones pues nacional, que es como Justicia y Paz, que siempre ha acompañado, y por parte de la Iglesia.
Yes, in our community there's the national human rights organizations like Justicia y Paz, and the church is accompanying us, and then international organizations like Peace Brigades International and the Fellowship of Reconciliation, for example, that have a presence in our community. Just recently, it's been very difficult for us because we have suffered again a blockade, a very strong, strict blockade, and also a lot of threats against the community.
Now, I've read a little about this, that is this the same street that was controlled by the paramilitaries that they were killing people on before, that now that they're imposing an economic blockade essentially to starve the community off, or what is the intention of the blockade?
Sí. Es en el mismo lugar, ha sido en la misma carretera, y el propósito es que de todas maneras, porque a nosotros nos ha golpeado de muchas maneras, económicamente a nosotros, los productos que hemos sacado al comercio nos han robado.
So, yes, it is the same road, and the idea is, yeah, I mean, we've been struck by in many different ways. One of the things is, for example, that the products that we harvest and that we bring to the market have been stolen. Also, the money that we need to do to buy things has been robbed. Or people go into the fields where we plant our products and harm them, and yeah, the idea is that we go hungry and that we leave. They want us to leave these lands.
Y más que todo son intereses económicos que hay allí en esas tierras, y también el la política y los gobiernos.
Yeah, it's above all economic interests in those lands. It's politics also. They want us to leave so that large ranches can be producing there, and that mines that are around there can be exploited, and for that we have to leave.
Are there foreign economic interests that are at play specifically in this area?
Sí. Hay intereses económicos extranjeros de explotar algunas minas que hay allí en nuestro territorio. Sabemos.
There's definitely foreign interests also. For example, the mines that are around there, they want to exploit those. And also, there's mega projects planned, like a dry canal that is supposed to unite the two oceans.
who is overseeing this? I know a lot of dam projects, things like that, are mm-hmm. often World Bank projects and the like. Is this state run, or is this also kind of, is there a transnational mm-hmm. Body that's overseeing that project?
Estos megaproyectos son desde afuera, son países extranjeros que tienen estos intereses allí.
Yeah, these are foreign economic interests, and you know, a lot has to do with the politics of the president here from the United States. It's their policies and. It's policies between governments. They make their pacts.
Now, is this something specific to the Bush administration, or has these economic patterns gone on previous to the recent administration?
Sí, lo que esto viene desde muchos gobiernos atrás. Siempre ha sido la política de ellos.
Yeah, this is from longer ago. And especially, for example, the Plan Colombia has affected our country a lot. Because this plan was supposedly to eradicate all the drug production, but we know that that's not what it really is. It's you know, in many communities and human rights organizations have always pronounced ourselves against this plan because we know that it's a plan to kill.
So I mean, the recent package of Plan Colombia, the U.S. has allotted over $1 billion. Primarily for military purposes under the auspices of the war on drugs. And now in kind of recent months, especially since September 11th, a lot of this has been more openly discussed as part of a counterinsurgency strategy. How does all this play in? Has this been consistent throughout and they're just using different ideological justifications, or has it always been a plan of control and domination to remove people?
Yo creo que por lo que pues, se alcanza a mirar, eso de todas maneras la ayuda de militar se está dando, y con eso lo que pasó después del 11 de septiembre.
Yeah, I think that
lo han.
You know, it, there's always been a lot of military aid, but especially since September 11th, it's been justified to you know, to enter many places and many different countries. And what happens is that this military aid goes to more helicopters, more weapons. More trainings, more men trained to kill, basically, and they kill the civilian population and the campesinos. Just like before, we saw that the plan to supposedly eradicate drug plantations, they have grown. Drug production has grown, you know, and now it's, you know, supposedly to get rid of the guerrilla, but, you know, that's not going to be, you know, it's never going to be enough. And it would need, like, a lot more Plan Colombias for that. What happens is that civilians and innocent people are being killed.
Okay, so the president who was just elected, Uribe, is from a far right-wing political party, and who has pretty well documented ties to paramilitary groups. Given that the paramilitaries are the primary people responsible for the violence against people from your community, what is your response to his being elected? And could you maybe tell a little bit more about the background, you know?
Sí, yo creo que frente a todos estos ataques, nosotros, incluso toda esta cantidad, no todos los casos, pero sí la mayoría de casos, lo conoce a nivel nacional, a nivel internacional. Hemos denunciado todo esto. La gente los conoce.
Yeah, in terms of all of these cases of attacks against us, they're well known. They're well known nationally and internationally. There's actually a commission that was created specifically to investigate these cases. And the case is in front of the Inter-American Human Rights Court. Because in Colombia, there's 100% impunity. All these cases are in impunity. And that's like the principal cause for, you know, that the situation remains the way it is. In Colombia, there's no justice.
And is Uribe using the rhetoric of a war on terrorism right now in Colombia, mm-hmm. as are many other repressive governments around the world?
Pues sí. Él en su política se ve como el hombre potente, el hombre capaz de derrotar a la guerrilla. Entonces mucha gente es seguidora de esa política.
Yeah, I mean, Uribe is, he is using that, and he's seen as the strong guy who is going to take care of the guerrilla, and that's how many people think, like, he's going to save the country from the war, but I think that's going to be very difficult. Because when Uribe was governor of Antioquia, which is the state where the peace community is, he created this organization Convivir that turned into paramilitaries, and he also did a lot of things for the region, like
las que el remanso de paz entre comillas,
que
remanso, que es un ya un territorio absolutamente
that,
paz.
Okay. That supposedly created the peace territories.
So he claims responsibility for having inspired the peace movement? No. Okay.
No. But, you know, again, this is, you know, territories in peace is in comillas.
Yeah. Orwellian.
And that the reality is different. You might not have, you know, all these, you know, massive massacres anymore, but there's selective killings that go on and that are not as well known. But I think, you know, people really have to see things from a different viewpoint. They have to really see the reality in Colombia, because I think many people have no idea of the reality in Colombia.
So people don't know that, you know, and the United Nations, other human rights groups have documented that the large majority of killings that have taken place in Colombia during the Civil War have been by state and paramilitary forces.
Sí, yo creo que la gente lo sabe, sobre todo pues, en Colombia, digamos que toda la gente. Pero yo me refiero más que todo, por ejemplo, aquí en Estados Unidos. La gente que da la plata.
Well, I do think that people know, especially in Colombia, but I'm talking more about people here in the United States. You know, those who give money to support things like Pan Colombia and all that, they have no idea what this money really does. And you know, because they're being told something else, and so they don't really know what's happening with that. Those people who give money to those kind of projects or Plan Colombia, they should come and visit Colombia, and they should come and visit those places where fumigations to eradicate drugs happen and see the damage that does. They should go and visit the displaced people who live in the slums in Bogota, Medellin, and they should come visit our community and see what war really does to us, and you know, see for themselves and see how people live and how poor people live and how in what misery they live, and they should see that, and so that then they could find out what this really all does, what the war does to people.
Do you think it would be fair to say that American taxpayers, whether they know it or not, are helping fund state terrorism in Colombia?
Claro que eso es una realidad. Y eso me baso yo, porque pues no sé quiénes, pero algunos dan su dinero y otros a través de los recursos que pagan
en
impuestos, claro que eso va hacia la guerra. Y cuando uno pone dineros, los deposita hacia la guerra, pues ten en cuenta que es a matar. es a matar gente, una cantidad de gente inocentes que no tienen que ver nada con el conflicto.
And just to reiterate, Plan Colombia is a aid package to Colombia, primarily military aid, so that essentially our tax dollars do go to fund the Colombian military, and they can use that, you know, to funnel money to paramilitaries if they needed to.
Sí, eso es lo que se conoce, y eso es una realidad. Eso va entre más apoyo a los militares colombianos, porque de hecho los mismos militares colombianos...
Yeah, definitely. The more money that goes to the Colombian military, the more that is being used to kill, because even, you know, soldiers also, the you know, members of the Colombian military, they murder and they burn down houses, and it's without doubt that they support the paramilitaries. That's very clear.
I was going to ask maybe one more question before we move on to the peace community. Just to also to clear it out, that the current president, the president-elect of Colombia, was the mayor of the state that you're from, Javier?
The president-elect?
Yes.
Governor. He was governor of the state of Antioquia.
Okay, and during this time he was connected to atrocities that were committed?
Yeah, he was the one who gave the green light for these kinds for the groups like Convivir and paramilitary groups.
Okay. Why don't we talk a little bit now about maybe what it's like to live in the peace community, and then we can go from there in terms of international support that people can do in the United States.
Sí, nosotros como comunidad, pues ya estamos resistiendo ya hace mucho tiempo frente a toda esta situación, y vemos que es como la única alternativa para
poder sobrevivir la guerra. As a peace community, we've been resisting this war for a long time now, and resisting to leave our lands, and we continue doing that, and that includes like some very fundamental things. One of the things that's very important is to be extremely transparent with all the armed actors. The unity also, the work that we do together, the fact that we don't think of, you know, just of myself, but of the community as a whole, that we love each other like brothers and compañeros, you know, all that is very important, the solidarity. That's what has maintained us, you know, the strength of our work, as a community together, and will continue to sustain us. But there's other things that are also very important, you know, the international solidarity, the accompaniment, the economic aid, and above all, the political support for the community to put pressure from different countries onto the Colombian government.
I have here a letter that Maury Sinchi, who's a congressman who represents us in Tompkins County, signed, trying to get other members of Congress to really draw attention to what's happening in the peace community, the fact that there are a number of people who are being murdered by paramilitaries, and also the economic blockade, the siege that the peace community is under. What other sorts of support are you getting from within the United States?
When's this letter from?
This is from May 24th, 2004. It's actually written to President Andres Pastrana.
It's sponsored, actually. It's signed by Maurice Hinchu.
Yes.
It was circulated by Sansar.
¿Qué cosas importantes eran que yo decía ahorita? Un apoyo político es, por ejemplo, puede ser una escuela, puede ser una iglesia, alguien mandar cartas al presidente, al vicepresidente, pues a la brigada, en apoyo.
Well, for example, letters that people or, you know, schools or churches can write to the president, the vice president, the brigade, the army brigade, in support of the peace community. That's very important political support that doesn't cost anything. And there is the aspect of economic aid. This is a community that's not very highly developed, so there are a lot of necessities. And then finally, people to visit us, to come and be present, be witnesses, you know, for a few days, for some time. That's very important to us. And maybe I can make a pitch here.
Absolutely.
The Fellowship of Reconciliation in November will sponsor a delegation going to San José de Apartado and possibly another peace community, because San José is one of about 50 peace communities that exist in Colombia. So if people are interested to join this delegation, it will be from the 9th to the 22nd of November. And you can get in touch with the San Francisco office of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. The email address would be forcolombia@igc.org.
Could talk about, for instance, the Bush doctrine of either you're with us or you're against us, you're with Bush or you're with the terrorists. That's certainly a lot more complicated in a situation like Colombia where there's violence on all sides. What in the pressures, I imagine there's a lot of pressures put on you from, you know, from the state or from the paramilitaries to pick sides. Certainly, I think that's one of the biggest dangers right now is this kind of one-sided so-called war on terrorism that has really given a lot of governments the green light to crack down on, you know, Chechens or Palestinians or whatever.
Sí, esto la presión más que todo es de sacarnos de nuestras tierras.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely a lot of pressure because they, like I said earlier, they want us to get off this land. So there's also a lot of pressure from this end saying, you know, oh yeah, they're collaborators with the guerrillas, they're guerrillas. And so, you know, just to justify a lot of actions against them to get us off the land. But again, people just have to come and see for themselves that that's not the reality. We do feel like that the war will get worse, and that especially in our region and in our community, you know, there will be more conflict. And so one thing that we know is really necessary is this international accompaniment, this international people who can give us the strength to maintain there.
That was Javier Sanchez of the peace community of San José de Apartado in Colombia, speaking with Lucas Shapiro in Ithaca last June. Jutta Meyer-Wiedenbach was the translator. We'll conclude the program tonight with a reading of a recent Letter to America from the Chilean author Ariel Dorfman, who is currently Professor of Literature and Latin American Studies at Duke University. An open letter to America was published on September 8th in the London Observer, Dorfman wrote. Let me tell you, America, of the hopes I had for you. As the smoke was swallowing Manhattan and the buildings fell and the terror spread into the farthest recesses of your land and your hearts, my hopes for you, America. While around the world many of the past victims of your own terror, your own attacks, were thinking and often saying and more often thinking, they deserve it, serves them right, it's about time they knew what it's like to be on the receiving end. Not true, I thought, I said. Nobody deserves terror. Justice. What we deserve, all of us, is some measure of justice. My hopes for America. Not that this was good for you. No, not that. But I have seen suffering before. I have seen widows wandering remote streets with the photos of their loved ones, asking if anyone knows if they are alive or dead. I have watched men and women, and even countries, turn their deepest sorrows into a source of strength, a form of self-knowledge, a chance to grow. A chance to grow, America, that was my hope. Loss. turned into maturity. A chance to understand. Not alone, America, not alone in your grief. A perpetual valley of terror, that is what most of humanity is born into day after faraway day. Ignoring if tomorrow we will once again be assaulted and bombed, humiliated and tormented. America, suddenly living what almost everyone else on this planet has experienced at some point yesterday or today, the precarious pit of everyday fear. My hope for America, empathy, compassion, the capacity to imagine that you are not unique. Yes, America, if this dreadful destruction were only to teach you that your citizens and your dead are not the only ones who matter on this planet, if that experience were to lead you to wage a resolute war on the multiple terrors that haunt our already murderous new century, an awakening, America, not to be, what did not happen. Your country hijacked, your panic used to take you on a journey of violence from which it is hard to return, the men at the controls not worried about crashing America into the world. But not just the fault of the men who misgovern you. They can only do what you have allowed them, responding those men to some of your deepest desires. Above all this, to be innocent again, to feel good about yourselves after Vietnam. Vietnam? That country you turned into a mass graveyard? Innocence handed back to you, America, on September 11, 2001. A terrible price to pay, but there it is. Those atrocities, that devastation, finally making you all into victims. No ifs, no buts, no listening to the naysayers. No patience for those who suggest you look at your own history, your own interventions across the globe, to understand why so many out there in the crazed world might detest you. No more self-doubt, America. Beware the plague of victimhood, America. The finger I point at you pointed back at my own self. I know that thrill. I have sweetly sucked it in. I have felt the surge of self-righteousness that comes from being unfairly hurt. Anything we do, justified. Any criticism against us, dismissed. Beware the plague of fear and rage, America. Nothing more dangerous, a giant who is afraid. Projecting power and terror so the demons within and without will not devour him, so the traumas of the past will not repeat themselves. Beware the plague of amnesia, America. Or have you forgotten Chile? Not just a name. Chile? Democratic Chile? Demonized, destabilized by your government in 1973? Chile, that country misruled for 17 years by a dictator you helped to install? And other countries, other names, Iran, Nicaragua, the Congo, Indonesia, South Africa, Laos, Guatemala, just names? Just footnotes in history books? Your creatures? But I do not speak to you only from afar. How could I not wish you well? You gave me an Americano from the Latino South, this language of love that I return to you. You gave me the hot summer afternoons of my childhood in Queens when my starkest choice was whether to buy a popsicle from the good humor man or the fat driver of the bungalow bar truck, and then back to calculating Jackie Robinson's batting average. How could I not wish you well? You gave me refuge when I was barely a toddler, my family fleeing the fascist thugs in Argentina in the mid-40s. One of you then, still one of you now, how could I not wish you well? Years later, again it was to America I came with my own family, an exile from the Chile of Pinochet you helped to spawn into existence on precisely an 11 September, another Tuesday of doom. And yet, still wishing you well, America, you offered me the freedom to speak out that I did not have in Santiago. You gave me the opportunity to write and teach. You gave me a gringa granddaughter. How could I not love the house she lives in? Where is that America of mine? Where is that other America? Where is the America of, as I would not be a slave, so I would not be a master? The America of, this land is our land, this land was meant for you and me. The America of all men and all women, every one of us on this ravaged, glorious earth of ours, all of us created equal. Created equal, one baby in Afghanistan or Iraq, as sacred as one baby in Minneapolis. Where is my America? The America that taught me tolerance of every race and every religion, that filled me with pioneer energy, that is generous to a fault when catastrophes strike. So was I wrong? When I hoped you would rise to the challenge as death visited you from the sky, when I believed America the just, the rebellious, the unselfish was still alive, not entirely spoiled by excessive wealth, with the courage to conquer its fear, America learning the lesson of Vietnam, Vietnam, more, many more than 3,000 dead, more, many more than two cities bombed, more than one day of terror. And yet they do not hate you, America. The enduring lesson of Vietnam, not next time obliterate the enemy, not next time satanize those who dissent. What the Vietnamese are whispering to you, they remember, and yet they do not hate. Not that easy, America, to forgive the pain. Or can you forget your own September 11th that easily? Not that easy, America. To grow. Or was I wrong? Have I become contaminated myself with your innocence, lived too long among you? Do you need 50,000 body bags coming home before you start to listen to your own voices of peace and dissent? Am I wrong to believe that the country that gave the world jazz and Faulkner and Eleanor Roosevelt will be able to look itself in the cracked mirror of history and join the rest of humanity, not as a city on a separate hill, but as one more city in the shining valleys of sorrow and uncertainty and hope where we all dwell? And that was An Open Letter to America by Chilean writer Ariel Dorfman, published in the London Observer on September 8th. Dorfman's most recent writings are Exercising Terror, The Incredible Unending Trial of General Augusto Pinochet from Seven Stories Press, and a book of poems, In Case of Fire in a Foreign Land from Duke University Press.
If you have an event you'd like us to announce or an issue you'd like us to cover on the program, you can contact us at our website at www.radioforall.org/unwelcome. That's radio, the number 4, ALL.org/unwelcome. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Unwelcome Guests is produced by Chris Sturr, Jesse Lind, Lynn Gary, and Sean Ewald. We are solely responsible for its content. By unwelcome travelers.